Today we're talking more about covenant and commitment, looking at the different relational forms of the Bible. So yesterday we talked about more explicitly about sex and using David and Solomon and looking at their greed and what God's actual objection was to their life choices. So we still have that. I kept that 1 Corinthians text on the top of our page for today, and there's a little handout here if everyone got one. As kind of our theme, and I imagine that maybe on Friday we'll really land on that text and dig into it. But for now, I just want it to be the general idea of our physicality. That'd be the theme that carries us, but we're not going to really study 1 Corinthians today. And just as a follow-up to yesterday, there was questions, looking at this 1 Corinthians text, there was questions about the Greek behind the word fornication and fornicators. So I did some looking it up, and the word for prostitute, fornication, and fornicators is all the same. Welcome.
Perfect to walk it on.
So if you look at there's three forms of the same Greek word. If you look at the first four Greek characters, they're all the same. The first letter is pi, P, O, that is an R sound, and then that V is actually an N sound. So that's a familiar word to our English ears. Porn is the root of all of those words. P-O-R-N. And as you can see from the definition that this one lexicon offered, it's not the one I like to use, but I didn't have access to what I needed. This lexicon, talks about the giving away of body. So hopefully that's helpful, but I did think it was interesting, the word we were interested in yesterday as far as the Greek. That the root of that is porn. Excuse me, I'm going to have to answer my child here. Okay, so that's just a follow-up from yesterday. Hopefully that's of some interest to you. And so today we're going to dig into covenant and commitment and look at the different ways that loyalty and promise and accompaniment is lifted up in the Bible, and I encourage you to read all the way to the bottom of the page. I just put some questions on there for you to have ruminating as you're reading different aspects of the text to look at. So I'm gonna get us moving right into the text so that we have time to hit some of these examples. Let's look first at Ruth. And if you've done Bible study with me before, you'll know that Ruth is maybe one of my favorite books in the Bible, if not my favorite. Just gotta find it. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. All right, so it's towards the beginning of the Old Testament, not too far after where we were part of yesterday, but the Torah, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. And just a very quick overview of the book of Ruth. It is the only book in the Old Testament where God is not an explicit active character. Actually, that's almost true in Esther as well. But this book follows a story of Ruth and Naomi, and they reference God, but God is not, you don't ever hear the text say, and then God said, or God did this. God is a belief system for these women, but not an active character in the story. So let me give you just the quick and dirty plot points here, and then we will look at a couple of texts. So Naomi was married and had two sons, and one of the sons married a woman named Ruth. The other son married a woman named Orpah, who who legend has it is who Oprah was supposed to be named after, but they spelled the name wrong on the first
time. Mm-hmm. Oh, good to know.
Yeah, I know. This is why we're at Bible study.
I heard her say that.
Yeah.
Really? On a program that.
Yeah. As urgent legends are from her mouth. So Orpah and Ruth, daughters-in-law of Naomi. All of the men in this family unit die, leaving the women, which means that they left the women very vulnerable, without any property rights, no source of income. And Naomi wants the best for these two young women, so she urges them to go back to their families of origin. Orpah obeys her and does that, and Ruth says something different. So look at Ruth chapter 1, verse 15. This is, you may have heard this like at a wedding before, which I always think is funny, because then if you told the bride and, you know, bride and groom, well, it's actually a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law. Yeah. A little different context, but starting at verse 15, we hear Ruth, or Naomi says, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me, and more as well, if even death parts me from you." So a real loyal young woman here, knowing that if she left Naomi, Naomi would be at complete and certain death. So Ruth is saving her life here and doing it, and just with this beautiful poetry. And I'm going to just cover the plot all the way to the end here so we can come back with some reflection. And then Naomi sets up, like a good Jewish mother, sets up Ruth to go and glean from a relative's field, which means taking the crops along the edges as their source of food. And this relative is named Boaz, and he's like a not the closest relative, but a little distant. And he's wealthy, and he meets Ruth and has the utmost integrity as a young man, has every opportunity to take advantage of her. She's poor and begging off of his field, and he makes a way for her and says, "No, you'll be safe here. You can glean with these people." And then I'm in chapter 3 now. Naomi's trying to further their security, and so she sends Ruth to Boaz at night and says, "Go and offer yourself to him." And Boaz maintains her dignity. I don't want to find out exactly where that is. So I'm looking at chapter 3, about verse 9. Boaz says, "Who are you?" And Ruth answers, "I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter, for this last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask, for all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman. But now, though it is true that I am in your kinsman, there is another kinsman more closely related than I." So he needs to go and ask the other relative if it's okay if he ends up with Ruth, "lie down until morning." And then even as we go further in verse 14, Boaz says, "It must not be known that this woman came to the threshing floor." So not only does he not take advantage of her, even though she's offering herself, but he respects her reputation and sends her out kind of under the cover of night, and with food so that she can be fed and maintain social standing. And then in chapter 4, they are married and have a son. And we hear this beautiful redemption at the very end. The redemption is ultimately for Naomi, who loves her grandson. And the women say to Naomi, the whole culture redeems her in saying, in verse 14, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be your restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." A daughter-in-law who loves you is more than seven sons. Pretty high praise, I think. And then the women of the neighborhood come and say, a son has been born to Naomi, and they name him Obed, and he becomes the father of Jesse, the father of David, and of course we know that Jesus ends up in this genealogy. So, was this a familiar story to people? I should have asked it at the get-go. Yeah? Oh, good. Okay, good. I just think it's underutilized in our scriptural knowledge. It's such a beautiful story of family and community and what can happen when two people are loyal to one another, even apart from kind of a culture that gives them certain death. So what did you hear of relationship there? There's a couple different places to look at relationship there.
Well, one of the things I bring to it, rightly or wrongly, is the remembrance that Ruth is a foreign woman.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday we read about Solomon falling in love with all these foreign women.
Yeah.
So I was sort of primed to read Ruth today, so that's...
Yeah.
And that has implications that we don't necessarily understand, but
right.
She was really not only female, and as you said, would have been sent back to her family, but outside the
mm-hmm.
Hebrew fold. Or
yeah, a Moabite. So if you take time to read this in with careful detail, you'll notice rarely she's simply called Ruth. She's often Ruth the Moabite. Throughout the whole story, she's Ruth the Moabite. And I think even when she ends up in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, I think she's also still called Ruth the Moabite. So there's this foreign blood in Jesus' lineage.
Well, not only that, did the Hebrews even eat with the people, or
It's curious to wonder even how that first marriage between Naomi's sons and this foreign woman came to be. That doesn't seem to be an issue of controversy at all.
I love that part at the beginning of chapter 3, which I think is still insightful for modern culture, that a mother-in-law would go out of her way to seek, as, you know, in my text it says, some security for you so
mm-hmm.
that it might be well with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think in the modern setup of families, it'd be very rare if someone had lost their partner for the in-laws to then say, we're actually going to bring you in and look after you.
Yeah.
I think that is generally rare.
Yeah.
So that, to me, is a very beautiful part of this text.
Yeah.
Especially, I think, when you're in those dangerous situations. A close friend of mine, his dad, grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, and his dad was in this neighborhood that was full of kind of row houses and across from a crack house, and it was a rougher neighborhood. But the row houses were built in such a way that generations of families kind of lived one floor on top of each other, and people often sat out on the stoops. So even though you had a lot of drug activity, you had a lot of violence within and around the neighborhood, they always felt really safe there because there was that kind of family structure and that kind of neighborliness looking over it. So that even though they were really kind of a marginalized group of people, the kind of commitment to each other within neighborhoods and within especially families. And like, you know, you just moved downstairs. So you started as a young person in the top floor, and then you would move down as you became less able to climb stairs.
I actually know someone who, a friend of mine lost her sister about 6 years ago, and her sister was married to this really wonderful guy. And I get, like you were saying, typically, in our culture nowadays, you know, I mean, the families would, you know, meet at the funeral and, but kind of eventually go their own separate ways, but this family has become even closer, and it's been really lovely. Her brother-in-law was part of the bridal party, and, like, it was like the two families had totally melded, and it was really beautiful.
I think it's interesting how, like, opposed to our story yesterday, like, everything was kind of, like, there was an opportunity for, you know, this kind of, like, exchange for, like, it was just, like, everything was out in the open. And so it was like you mentioned, how God wasn't an active character, but it was almost like God didn't have to intervene because, you know, people were still holding some sort of you know, a moral fiber.
Yeah, good. Yeah, there's a real, when you think about those stories from yesterday, there's a real juxtaposition between that greed that we saw, just that overwhelming ego greed, and the selflessness of Ruth and Boaz, both, where ego is not a role here. So it's an interesting thing to hold together.
I saw, I thought it was interesting that they didn't feel like there was any judgment in the story. Like, especially the part where Naomi says to Ruth, go and lie with this guy, or, well, go offer it to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, in the story itself, no, like, condemning of that or condoning of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Was there, and, you know, I should know this, but I don't, was there actually, like, a legal aspect to marriage?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is now, you know, I mean, where people had to go buy a marriage license, and there was a legal paper.
Yeah, it evolved throughout the whole arc of the Old Testament, but by and large, the legal rights stayed with the man, and the woman was more of a investment or property. Of course, not always. There's a lot of examples of love relationships in the Old Testament, so I don't want to just paint that as a blanket statement. But a man had every right to divorce his wife, which is why Jesus teaches so heavily against divorce, is because divorce was so abused in the Old Testament. And a woman had no rights, could not leave your husband. Or if you did, it was a voluntary move into homelessness, and a real shameful one at that. So,
so how does that transfer over in the church in today's world for people that perhaps don't want to do the legal piece of paper and say they're married?
Say more.
Well, I have my father-in-law, and my mother-in-law passed away, and he wanted to marry someone else.
Mm-hmm.
They got married in the church, but they didn't file the legal paper.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it had to do because, you know, you have investments, you have retirement, you have other family. I think somebody mentioned yesterday that, you know, somebody in their family died and then left everything to this other person, you know, and this was more or less to protect what he had. I mean, if he married someone else, then, you know, everything would legally go to her rather than to his children.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, where is the church stance on that kind of?
I could tell you what my bishop did.
Okay.
his wife's stepfather, actually, when Dee Dee's mom died, then her stepdad and another friend, they decided to get married. And if they would do that by the state, I think they would both lose pensions big time.
Right.
And so the bishop, as a pastor, blessed their union.
This is what you're
so the church stands in a lot of different places on that.
Yeah.
I mean, is that seen as an okay thing to do in the church now? I mean, because there's a lot of us that are older that are, you know, widows or widowers, and, you know, it's like, do we want to be legally
The other thing that Chris says, the bishop, is marriage is a state issue.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are all laws of the state. They're not religious laws.
But in this
they're not
story,
faith laws.
And this story, I think, gives some clues because Boaz, there's the detail that Boaz doesn't lie with her because that would just mess it up for her. I mean, even... So it's what will... How will people come out of this whole? Whole as a married couple, whole as a community. And I don't think there's any threat to wholeness by people being blessed without the legal stuff. I mean, if you think about what's marriage for in our society, companionship and a household and trust, and how are those things not met?
by our cuckoo tax law that keeps people up now.
Well, and I understand it in younger people, and I understand it for people that want that, you know, in same-sex marriages and that kind of thing for the benefit. But for some people, there is no benefit. You know, it's more of a benefit to not make it a legal state. So I think we need to know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think exactly what Elaine said. The church is a huge, that's as diverse as saying, what does all of humanity think about this?
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, what everyone is talking about, is, I think, is so wise, that the idea of wholeness and relationship. Now, there will be plenty of clergy that will disagree with me, but I think any relationship, whether it's hetero or homo or legally recognized or not, the integrity, the loyalty, the commitment, from what we've read so far, those are things that God cares a whole lot about.
More so.
More so. Now, in order to maintain someone else's integrity, you do have to think about their social standings. In some cultures, Boaz thought heavily on Ruth's social standings. And if I think, if anything, that's the best reason not to sleep with her. There wasn't a, because sex is bad. It was, he maintained her dignity and who she was as a person in that culture. I mean, as a Moabite, she was so far down the chain.
Right.
So he did everything he could to raise her up in the world that she lived in. And so from only this clergy can I say that's what I think God is really interested in our relationships. And I don't think that's being loose with it. I think that's a pretty high standard in a world where divorce is the norm and sleeping around is the norm. I think that holds a pretty high line if you really want to take it seriously. Other thoughts?
I was really struck by Boaz's behavior. Really reminded me of Joseph when he was confronted with Mary, realizing this woman to whom he was engaged was pregnant, and he had this opportunity again. He would have been totally within his rights of the time, but he decided to divorce her quietly until the angel came and talked to him. So I was struck by that, and I think it's interesting that this also is in Jesus' line. So there's a history of compassionate, considerate men, along with David and all these other guys. But it kind of balances out.
Yeah, that confirmation class I talked about yesterday. When we got to Ruth, I got to teach the story, and the kids drew trace outlines of their bodies. The girls did one, or a couple, and the boys had to do a couple, and then they flip-flopped, and they had to make their dream man and their dream woman, and then we read Ruth and talked about, you know, what a great guy Boaz is, and then, like, these are the characteristics you want to find in your partner and your boyfriends, and then, of course, flip-flopped it for the guys, but anyways, it was... It's an unusual story to use in that kind of context, but it's just a beautiful story of relationship. Let's look at a couple others. The whale took up time away. 1 Samuel 18, just a couple books down the road, or a book down the road.
Okay.
1 Samuel 18. I'm sorry, do I need a big print version?
Only when I forget my glasses.
So we talked about David yesterday, and this is a kind of a younger David before he is king of all kings. David was competing with Saul for kingship, and ultimately David, of course, won out. Saul had a son named Jonathan. And we're going to pick up the story of Jonathan and David. And some of the language used in these next couple chapters are unprecedented in the Old Testament, the bond between these two. So let me just read this quick, starting at 18. I might do some jumping around. When David had finished speaking to Saul, his total competitive enemy at this point, the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him as a result of Jonathan's covenant. Saul sent him over the army and all the people, even the servants of Saul approved. And then David, in an odd twist, ends up marrying Jonathan's sister, Michal. There's a little bit more. Oh, and then in 19, Jonathan, his bond to David is so great that he even betrays his father and tells David about Saul's plan to kill him, and then saves David. And then I'm in 20 here, the friendship of David and Jonathan. David came before Jonathan and said, "What have I done? Where is my guilt? And what is the sin against your father that he's trying to take my life?" He said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. My father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me, and why should my father hide this from me? Never." But David also swore, "Your father knows well that you like me, and he thinks," I think the word like, I need to see what Hebrew is there, that just seems so weak. "And he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death." And then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." And they concoct a plan to save David. So Saul, or Jonathan, distracts Saul. And then at the very end of this book, I guess, I don't know that we get much more with the two of them, but at the very end of this book, Saul and Jonathan die. And in the beginning of 2 Samuel, we hear that David mourns in 2 Samuel 1:11. Sorry, and I'm really jumping here. So this is after he heard of his friend's death. "David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and all the men who were with him did the same. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." So that is a quick arc of the relationship between those two. What do you think? It's an unlikely pairing. They come from warring families that tried to be on the same side, but David and Saul's ego is always in the way and threatened by David. And so Jonathan betrays family because of his love for his friend.
It's kind of like Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
But with dudes.
Yeah.
My first thought was Frodo and Sam.
Frodo and Sam.
Oh.
I think it's important to also sort of divorce what we bring as modern readers to what this actually means at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Sexuality, as we know it, didn't really exist until about 150 years ago. And Freud sort of made a nice little stew out of it. At the time this was written, if I were paired with Elaine, that wouldn't make me straight. And if I then went and had, you know, sex with Andrew, that wouldn't make me gay. This was all happening. If you look at classical literature of what we have, 5% probably of what existed, what's happening with Sappho and on the island of Lesbos, this was all normal. We were all just having fun. You know, and there weren't age restrictions or anything like this. I understand where we're going with this. This is a great, I would love to be like, oh, look, same-sex unity in the Bible. But the reality is we were all doing whatever we wanted at the time. You know, the actual term that usually gets blamed in Romans, David Fredrickson at Luther Seminary said that word did not come into existence in classical text until that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it doesn't mean homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
It means male rape. I would hope and pray this is a great love story, if in fact that is what it is, but given the time in which it's written,
mm-hmm.
those things aren't necessarily possible, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, a big part of why I chose this text is because the vocabulary is so very unique that it isn't. It doesn't have, you know, as we look at this Greek word with that root of corn or anything like that, the vocabulary here is so sweet. I mean, it's Song of Solomon-esque with its, with a soul being bonded to another soul.
And what I think, at least for me, when I bring my modern reading to it, is sort of that hope of where do we go emotionally with each other when we're living in community. It doesn't have to be just a man with a man, but a man with a woman. And what do you bring to your individual relationships? Oftentimes we don't. I don't always go, oh, Katie, this is what you mean to me in the depths of my soul. But this gives us a nice example of what that could be if we could sort of shed some of that armor of what we bring to our relationships, I think.
In some countries today, I know I had a friend that's you some East Indians. I'm Native Americans, were living near me, so I always say East Indians. But a woman was to be married to a gay man, and it might have been a problem for her, but that wasn't considered serious. As long as they could produce a child, it was nobody's business. And I think that's true in many countries today, that if, as long as you don't make a big deal out of it, that, and you can produce a child, it simply doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. What's the point of producing a child that just is sad that would be the standard, in my opinion.
But it's just the deep, improving fertility and the death rate, even in third world countries, was formerly higher than it was now. And to be able to produce enough children to survive you was just, and it's probably genetic in all of us, but we've overridden it with several things we know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just in what I'm hearing you say and in this story, or even what Taylor's reflecting on, what society says about the relationships is as formative for us as anything. And so I think part of this, what I'm hoping in this Bible study, is that we can lift up Scripture to be as formative for us as human beings in our relationships.
I hate to sound naive or whatever, or shallow or whatever I may sound like, but I'm not even sure I understand why sexuality enters into this relationship.
Right. I was thinking more, you know, some families deserve to be betrayed. You know, maybe he was more like family than his family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who's to say who your family is? Just because you're genetically tied to them doesn't mean they're your true family.
Mm-hmm. I think many would not read sexuality into this, and that isn't why I raised it. I mean, I truly the bond here is.
Yeah, I mean that's what I read this story of, and I don't know. Maybe our culture isn't as comfortable with two men who have a close bond as is demonstrated in this story. Maybe if it was two women, we wouldn't give it a second thought.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, considering we just got done reflecting on Ruth, and that sextant came up there. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Soldiers on the battlefield have that bond.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, this relationship between Jonathan and David reminds me a lot of Patroclus and Achilles in the Iliad, if you've read the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
There's this great bond, and in fact, Patroclus' death is the only way in which Achilles, his rage consumes him, his sorrow is so deep that it's only through those emotions that he's able to defeat Hector, this other great warrior, or the same of Enkidu and Gilgamesh in this epic. So, I think this is a pattern. I'm not a scholar, but it seems to me that this is a pattern that perhaps it is a more modern connotation for us that this somehow feels different, but this bonding of two men, especially kind of a battle sense.
Well, look in popular culture too, Amos and Andy and Mutt and Jeff.
Help me out.
Their wives were secondary, and nobody thinks, you know.
Well, look at Beavis and Butthead.
Andy and Barney, right? Andy and
yeah.
I think one of the things.
See Beavis and Butthead's wives.
Like, the one thing that I see, between these two stories, I see a lot of loyalty, and I actually struggle with that, because I wonder if this story brings it out to me more than even, like, a friend doing something really drastic for another friend, than even Jesus dying on the cross. Because, I mean, in a way, we talk about Jesus dying on the cross so much that it, like, in this, I'm just like, why would he do that? I mean, that's just like loyalty that's forsaking, you know, family. And like maybe there's things about, like moral things about one or the other that, like, are they forsaking? I don't know, maybe I'm just being too morally grounded or something, but.
For the gospel reading this past year? You have to forsake mother and father.
Yeah.
Hate mother.
Yeah, hate mother and father.
John did that.
Yeah, I mean, is that the example we should live by? Like, is loyalty more important than standing up for what is right, or is loyalty standing up for what is right?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question. Yeah, and I think, you know, if you had a girlfriend of yours that was a young widow and chose to stay, you know, out on the farm with ma-in-law, and see her 20s and 30s and 40s go away, or, you know, move back with her family and have prospects of getting married again or whatever, I can imagine what my advice would be to that, my young friend. You know, I mean, that, I think that's exactly why these stories are important, is that kind of loyalty is, it's like offensive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's unheard of, and it does, yeah, we can take Jesus' loyalty to us and kind of chalk it up to, well, he's divine. So, thank God I'm not having to do any of that. And then we have Ruth and we have Jonathan, and they give us, and Boaz, and give us these beautiful examples of, of what is worthy of forsaking and what is worthy of holding on to as loyal. There is no black and white here. That's all gray zone for everyone. That's going to be a different standard and decision.
Whatever's the hardest is what God wants you to do. That's my
philosophy. I hope that's true. I want us.
It always works out that way.
But I think there's sometimes that there's the parting of the Red Sea, and that you better walk across when you see that.
No.
Don't you think so?
I think we don't walk alone. Just to honor your time, it is past the end of our Bible study. I am going to just keep going, but you can leave, and no one will be offended by that.
How do you know?
I will speak for us all. No one's allowed to get offended. Let's jump all the way to 1 Corinthians 7, which follows, of course, the verse that's on the top of your page. Because there's another kind of commitment and covenant that is very important and rarely gets lifted up in the church, and that is the decision to marry or not marry, of singleness and being in a relationship. And Paul has, of course, a lot to say about that. Let me read us through 1 Corinthians 7 here. I'm just going to get us some highlights. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, this is like a pastor writing back to his church that just sent him, 20 questions or something. It is well for a man not to touch a woman, but because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each white woman her own husband. The woman should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. I appreciate his mutuality there. Going down to 8. To the unmarried and the widows, I say it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they are not practicing self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion.
Yeah.
To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or else she be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. So this whole chapter is just fascinating on Paul's teaching on relationships. But here, what I do appreciate about his teaching, and this is not always the case with Paul and men and women, but in this teaching, there is a mutuality of respect and that selflessness of Ruth and Jonathan, of a giving of yourself to the other for the sake of keeping one in check. And how is your relationship with God? These are really important questions in regards to the relationship here for Paul. Paul doesn't want anyone to be frustrated or making bad decisions. And so if that is the case, then get yourself in a marriage. I mean, that sounds a little clinical, very clinical. But I just appreciate the thoughtfulness of this teaching. What are your thoughts?
It's interesting with that mutuality. I've given it a lot of thought over the past couple of years. I've written about it here a little bit. And so, but one of my really close friends was raped, and that was a thing that I was kind of working through. And then after that happened, another friend who is a mother asked how she should talk to her children about rape. Like, how do I tell my daughters? How do I have this conversation with them? And I had asked Liz, my friend, like, what would you say? One of the things she talked about, she's like, there's a lot of ways you can talk about it. You can talk about the legal definition in terms of yes, no, drunk, not, 18, not. And she's like, but there's another really thing, and that's, she said, I don't believe consent is just saying yes. Consent is checking in and making sure that both people are comfortable with anything that you are doing or not doing, whether it's holding someone's hand or the way that you touch somebody, but it's that sort of mutuality checking in, and kind of like maybe the oneness that comes from that or not, but being willing to back away both people if it seems uncomfortable. And I don't know, I think maybe that idea of belonging and that idea of kind of giving of self is maybe somewhat present in this verse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A very brave man in our church admitted that he'd been raped as an adult, and that was just, you know, a very, you know, he went to, you know, what he really had, when it had post-traumatic stress syndrome, and it took him more than 10 years to be able to live a somewhat normal life. So he couldn't keep a job for a while, and so it's not just women. But most guys, it happens more to guys than we realize it. But mm-hmm. Very few of them talk about it.
Yeah.
And it took him for a long time before he could. I mean, he didn't trust women or men. He couldn't be close to anyone for a long time.
Yeah. There's another day this week that I've earmarked for talking about the role of excess in our society, around, be it around sex or substance or whatever it is, this is a part where the church needs to have a voice. These teachings are still the living word of God that have something to say to us as living children of God. And as Paul is writing, to be navigating about how you're doing and how you are affecting your society as a single person, as an intentionally unmarried or married person, how you're helping one another to be accountable, not for the sake of moral righteousness, but for the sake that everyone might have life abundantly and not harmfully. I think that is the core of this Bible study and of our conversations, is that every human should be allowed the right of supportive and giving relationships, and it's something that I think our world is just starved of.
What was the? I remember a verse sort of like this one that says that anybody who marries a divorced woman causes her to commit adultery and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And of course, they read that the Sunday after I married my second husband. Mm-hmm. It was a little traumatic for me at the time, And I remember going to the pastor and saying, so
what's up with that?
Yeah, exactly. I was much more upset at the time. And he said that, and I don't know, you know, what your take on it or anybody else's take on it, but he said at the time that the part that it makes me nervous about reading any part of the Bible is not being a Bible scholar. If you read that literally, it's more than rough. It's actually misleading sometimes. And he said that at the time that that was written, that men were had more rights than women, and that they were very promiscuous. And if they got tired of whatever wife they were with, since they were not in a multi-marriage situation, they would just say to her, I divorce you, and walk away to be with their new wife, leaving this other woman without any status or any means. And, you know, too bad for her. Mm-hmm. And so that he said that part of the text was in direct response to the culture of the time. Mm-hmm. Is that your understanding?
Mm-hmm.
What is this part right here? It says that if you're divorced, it's better to stay divorced. Is that what I heard? Did I hear it wrong?
And if we go on in 7, you'll hear, I mean, Paul even says, in the crisis of our time, Paul thinks the world's ending in the next couple blinks here. So he says, the bottom line is, like, don't fuss with it. If you're unmarried, stay unmarried. If you're married, stay married. Because Jesus is coming right back, so don't waste your time, you know, doing all that stuff. Yeah, but that is my understanding of what you quoted is Jesus' teaching on divorce. And I said this earlier on that, not in this much detail, though, is that the Old Testament use of divorce is so abused and so awful for women that really Jesus is lifting it up. And we see it as like, gosh, that's really harsh for divorced people. But really, it's an equality. I mean, there's an equality there in Jesus' teaching.
So you would not read that quite so literally,
right? Yep. Yeah. There's a lot.
Or just rip out Leviticus if you want, Penny. Rip out Leviticus. This is it's not a biblical thing, but one of my favorite. Series of books is the Chronicles of Narnia, and in one of them, I think Elaine, you were telling me, it was the horse and his boy. There's the scene where the boy is asking Aslan about somebody else, about what they had done, and in kind of a sense of, you know, passing judgment. And Aslan just says simply, "It's not your story." So I don't know. I go back to that a lot, and even though it's not really in the Bible, it seems to make a lot of sense to me. It's just simply not my story.
No, but it is my story.
Okay. But yeah, I'm saying from outside perspective.
I didn't put it on there. There was one more covenant I wanted to lift up is, you know, we all come to these stories and the scripture in so many different ways. Never married, divorced, remarried, widowed, widower, and the one covenant that is for all people regardless of relational status is the covenant that God makes with Abraham, and that is renewed in Christ, and that is a covenant to always be our God, and that we will always be God's people. And so that is the covenant that we stand on as we embark in relationships with one another. So let that be your guide today as you go off to be Ruth's and Jonathan's to one another, self-giving and honoring of the other. Thank you, and we'll pick it up again tomorrow.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you all.
Yeah.